of thousands of Iraqi deaths. Colin Powell served three Republican presidents in senior posts and reached the top of the U.S. military as it was regaining its vigor after the trauma of the Vietnam War. He was reportedly also an officer responsible for covering up the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. However, former U.S. President Donald Trump lambasted the media on Tuesday, 19th of October, for what he said was too favorable coverage of Colin Powell following his death. Donald Trump said in a statement, "Wonderful to see Colin Powell, who made big mistakes on Iraq and famously so-called weapons of mass destruction, be treated in death so beautifully by the fake news media. Hope that happens to me someday." Donald Trump added, "He made plenty of mistakes, but anyway, may he rest in peace." This bipartisan outpouring of grief at the passing of Colin Powell is something I find quite sickening and offensive. But like most sickening and offensive things, it deserves more scrutiny. And it can tell us a lot about how the propaganda matrix and the engine grease of empire actually works. This guy was their dude, a faithful servant of both wings of the war party, a good soldier to the very last breath. People use this opportunity to rewrite their history. People in power, that is. And you know, we can send condolences to his family. Presumably we're all well raised by our parents and taught not to speak ill of the dead. In the first place, it shouldn't apply to public figures because they can't be protected from the consequences of their own actions with false adulation. Secondly, it can't apply to their legacy, their deeds, or to history itself. There is a third point which is too seldom made. Public and official grief serves as a massive opportunity phase for the propaganda artists of the established order to jump in and use the sense of mourning and admiration and the muted dissent required by civil society just to lie and to keep lying. So in that sense, we're doubly required to counter that propaganda and those lies. Because all we have is our own media and our own microphones. The international pro-imperialist media and the corporate media will just spout the same lies, and that is a very dangerous thing. As a human, I can quote English poet, writer and scholar John Donne with the best of them and say that any man's death diminishes me because I'm involved in mankind. But I'm not going to be standing around singing "Abide with Me" at his funeral. This is a guy who was one of the earliest cover-up criminals and apologists of the My Lai massacre when he was barely 30 years old, and dismissed the letter written by a soldier detailing the horrors of the war was probably not reliable because the US Army had excellent relations with the Vietnamese people. He said, "Then when he was actually Secretary of State, he told American television and radio host Larry King that things like this happen in war, but was quick to say that they were deplorable, of course, and it all happened before he got there, etc." Never admitted his true role and his true allegiance. And then, of course, doubled down. That's what they do. They always double down if they're left in this cesspool of rotating positions and assignments. He became Secretary of State and made an even bigger mockery of truth as an even more obsequious servant of empire with what we call the vile, vile episode. He went before the United Nations with that stunt. It can only be called a stunt, holding up a little vial of nothing and going on and on with what he knew at the time to be a lie. That's important to point out. They all knew that they were lying. It was a lie about Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction, the infamous scaremongering about the ability to deliver chemical weapons over London in just 45 minutes. All of that was a pack of outright lies, which cost millions of people their lives, unimaginable suffering, and which is still causing massive suffering not only around the world, but also here in the United States, in the core of imperialism. Wasted trillions of dollars. A waste to us, of course, but not to Halliburton and Lockheed Martin and Boeing and Blackwater and all the other corporations that benefited so handsomely from it. But it didn't go to the things that government is supposed to do for its own people. That's why China has high-speed rail and we don't. That's why so much of the world has free healthcare and we don't. That's why most of the world has free education and we don't. That's the connection. There is always a connection between the viciousness and the murderous assault of the imperial juggernaut on the global south and what happens here at home. The violence, the militarization of the police, who now patrol marginalized communities as an occupying army bristling with weapons of war, it has all come home. Colin Powell's funeral acts as a sort of epicenter of the attempt to whitewash this reality, so I think it fitting that he was one of the early whitewashers of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. Because the whole event is another opportunity for the empire and for the criminals in both sides of the war party to come together to realize their shared interests, which are inimical to the interests of the people of this country and of the world in general, to pat each other on the back and to rewrite history. At work is a larger cover-up, that of a legacy, a history, and a system that is a stain on humanity. We mustn't let them succeed.
Communique.
Seven people were shot dead and dozens more wounded in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, after snipers belonging to the Lebanese Forces militia opened fire at a peaceful protest led by Hezbollah and Amal protesters. In the mainstream media, they've called them clashes. Many Lebanese accuse them of purposely hiding or obfuscating the identities of the victims and even of blaming Hezbollah for the violence. So were these just clashes, as some in the media have suggested, or something more sinister aimed at provoking a reaction from Hezbollah, an escalation, and dragging Lebanon into a civil war? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. October 14th, seven people were martyred and dozens more wounded after snipers opened fire at protesters in Beirut's Fayoum district. The majority of the victims, supporters of Hezbollah and its ally, the Amal movement, who gathered outside the Palace of Justice. Intended as a peaceful, unarmed protest, Hezbollah called for the demonstration the day before to protest against a judge named Tariq Bitar, who people accuse of politicizing the investigation into the Beirut port explosion. Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar reported that the American ambassador to Lebanon, Dorothy Shia, was attempting to frame Hezbollah for the explosion and influence the investigation. As protesters gathered outside the Palace of Justice, sniper fire began to erupt as gunmen on the surrounding buildings began firing at the protesters from rooftops and other vantage points. After the violence erupted, the armed wings of these groups then arrived with weapons to defend the protesters. And I think this is a very important point to understand, because some people in the Western mainstream media and Lebanese media have referred to the massacre as a clash, implying an exchange of fire between two sides. But is that really how things went down? Because when snipers start shooting at protesters, that's an ambush, it's an attack, it's not a clash, which would require both sides to be fighting from the start. Now, some people have also posted videos online saying, look, you see, the protesters were armed. Hezbollah and Amal, they brought weapons to the protest. They asked for it. But this is, again, untrue. One of the martyrs was a mother waiting at the window for her children to come home from school. She wasn't even at the protest, let alone carrying a weapon. How do you explain her death? The demonstration that took place was live-streamed. There are tons of videos and photographs showing very clearly that no one was armed. You can see here, as the shooting begins, there isn't a single weapon in the entire shot. The videos of people carrying weapons are from afterwards, after the snipers had already shot and killed protesters. It's only then that people came from nearby districts in order to defend the protesters. So that's a completely different story and a very important distinction to make. All the victims had head wounds, indicating a clear intent to kill, not to deter, nor disperse, nor defend, or whatever other excuse the apologists for this massacre have concocted. The Lebanese army even put out a tweet confirming that protesters had been shot at. They didn't say that armed groups or personnel were shot at, they said protesters. The Minister of Interior also confirmed that this was indeed a massacre, an ambush, and not some clash. Of course, some people in the media, they don't even want to disclose the identity of the victims. Hezbollah is always the bad guy, according to them. So when Hezbollah supporters are being massacred in broad daylight, this runs counter to their usual narrative. And if you look at the various headlines in the press, you can see how they use this passive language to avoid telling the truth. If you read their headlines, you would never know what actually happened and who was shot at. So they're basically lying about what happened, either calling it a clash or trying to obfuscate the identity of the victims. And we know that the victims are mostly Hezbollah and Hamas supporters. So what about the perpetrators? Who was behind the attack? Well, the Lebanese army has so far arrested a total of 19 people in connection with the attack. It is widely assumed that a right-wing Christian militia and a rival of Hezbollah, known as the Lebanese Forces, they were behind the massacre. And if you knew anything about the history of the Lebanese Forces and the history of their leader, Samir Jaja, this would hardly surprise you. As a matter of fact, this recent attack pales in comparison with their other atrocities when they killed scores of Christians, Muslims, Palestinians, Armenians. Not only that, but during the Lebanese Civil War, the Lebanese Forces militia committed treason and collaborated with Israel, an invading and occupying force, to carry out these attacks. They received funding, clothing, and weapons from the Israelis. And in September 1982, together, they committed one of the most horrific massacres, murdering 3,500 Palestinians and Lebanese Shia in Beirut. The leader of the Lebanese Forces militia, Samir Jaja, was also found guilty of assassinating the Lebanese Prime Minister, Rashid Karami, in 1987, and Danish Amoun in 1990. Today, Jaja also enjoys funding and support from Saudi Arabia and the United States, who have a vested interest in fracturing Lebanon and weakening Hezbollah.
One of the victims, Mohammed Tamer, is reported to have been killed not by the Lebanese Forces militia, but actually by the Lebanese army. The authenticity of CCTV footage posted online appeared to be confirmed when the Lebanese army said that the soldier in question is now under investigation.
The scenes of this latest massacre in Beirut are a painful reminder to many of Lebanon's civil war, which lasted 15 years and took place on these very streets. It is with that in mind that Hezbollah and Amal released an official statement following the shooting, asking people to remain calm and refrain from retaliating to the murders, for fear of escalating the situation and dragging Lebanon into another civil war. which is perhaps what Jaja and his backers would very much like to do. To discuss more, I'm joined by Zainab Al-Safar. She's an Iraqi-Lebanese journalist and the host of the television program Min Al-Dakhil, which airs weekly on Al-Mayadeen. First of all, let me say thank you, Zainab, for coming on the program. It's great to finally have you on the show.
Thank you for having me, Richard. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
So, Zainab, can you perhaps just walk us through what happened yesterday in Beirut? First of all, why were people outside? What were they protesting against? Who was protesting? And what is really the issue at hand?
At the night before, the eve before, there were certain kind of suspicious movements in the neighborhoods facing the place that the events took place yesterday. And this is something very suspicious because, you know, when such kind of movements, mobilizations take place by people in black and they are trying to secure certain kind of neighborhoods, avenues, and streets, and they were trying to deploy their militias over there, and the security forces and the various security forces, they didn't move an eye to all this kind of movement. We have to ask questions and we have to pose questions as, where is the preemptive security that ought to be there at certain points in time? So the next day, the people who were on the streets, let me just tell you and walk you through the events that took place. It is in repercussion to the politicizing of the judge that is in charge of the probe of the Beirut blast that occurred last year on the 4th of August. This particular judge, this unfortunately, we tend to call them justice, but there is no justice in what they are doing. His measures are so discretionary and politicized to the sense that he wanted to deviate the probe from its ultimate aims. And he issued certain kind of subpoenas and orders that were really so suspicious. They were highly politicized. There is no kind of justice or order in whatever he was doing. So the people took to the streets, civilians, unarmed, peaceful demonstrators, people who belong to the elite of Lebanon, lawyers, engineers, teachers. They took to the streets and they were unarmed. Okay, so what happened is that the moment they took to the streets at 10:45 a.m. exactly, fire, sniper fire, heavy, a salvo of sniper fire were started to shoot in their direction. We had seven martyrs, among them a woman, Maryam Farhat. She's the mother of five. I cannot just put them into words and say what has happened. It's like a kind of dragging the people. The events, you know, if you just want to paint the picture, they were so much reminiscent of what took place, what instigated the Lebanese Civil War back in 1975. The place and the way the events were taking place and escalating. 4 hours of intense gunfire, incessant gunfire. What does that mean? And nothing happened to stop them.
When you mention this poor woman who was killed in her home and, you know, the protesters were unarmed, I mean, this is a very important point because you have a lot of people posting videos, people online saying that the protesters were armed, that they came to the protest with weapons. Is that true? Or were those videos from afterwards, after the snipers had already shot and killed some of the protesters in front of the Palace of Justice?
Unfortunately, Richard, a lot of media outlets, local media outlets and foreign media outlets, are accomplices in the crime that took place against the people, the innocent people of demonstration. The way they were trying to promote that this matter has boiled down into clashes. Clashes take place between two sides. But this is, you know, the Lebanese forces, militias, those lunatic mercenaries, performing, perpetrating this massacre, this intended, pre-planned, pre-orchestrated, and perpetrated massacre against civilians. They were trying to show that the matter is only a kind of clashes, you know, an action and a reaction. No way. Nobody. We said and we underscored the fact that those protesters were unarmed and were peaceful, and they were from the elite, as I said. Those people, they shot at a demonstration, demonstrators, they shot back and there was an exchange of fire. This was not the case at all. only the army, you know, deployed, and they deployed their armored personnel, and they were trying to take hold of the situation. 4 hours of intense fire until they tried to apprehend those perpetrators, and 8 of them are apprehended, and they said that, well, they admitted what they were doing.
What did you make of not just local commentators, but international media portraying it as, you know, a fight between two sides, and omitting the victims, that they're Hezbollah and Amal supporters, from the headlines, the subheadings, you know, it just wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. It was a kind of, you know, it's part also of the whole choir of trying to show that, well, you know, it's the beginning, the flames of a civil war that is has just erupted and is going to burn Lebanon. It's between a Christian side, you know, and even in the geography, Na'in al-Rumani, you say Christian side, populated by the Christians, and then you say Ash-Shia and Tayyuni is populated by the Shia mostly, and you say that, well, it's a kind of civil war between the Christians and the Shia, Amal and Hezbollah. They represent the greatest number of Shia in Lebanon, but this was not that, and this is what they want to sell, because, you know, as we all know, that Hezbollah has a very deep-rooted alliance with the Free Patriotic Movement, which is one of the biggest Christian parties in Lebanon, and also Amal Movement has also alliance with the Merida. Hezbollah has also with the Merida. They are all Christians, and they are also people who suffered from the massacres perpetrated by the Lebanese forces against their own people, the Christians, their fellow Christians themselves. The Lebanese forces, party and militia, what they were doing is what they have always been doing, what they are used to be doing. They are mercenaries in the hands of those who pay the higher bid. You know, they are funded by certain Arab regimes, and they take the orders from the Americans, and they perpetrate massacres. We don't, it does not escape us ever, you know, what happened in Sabra and Shatila, and who was responsible for what happened in Sabra and Shatila, where 3,500 people, innocent Palestinians and Lebanese, at least 80 people from Al-Muqdad family, they have been assassinated in a mode which is, they have been butchered. Women, children, elderly, they have been butchered in the Sabra neighborhood, just adjacent to the Shatila refugee camp.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the Lebanese army, they arrested members of this Christian militia, the Lebanese forces, for this attack. But it's not really out of place for them, is it? I mean, they have a whole history of this barbarism, let's call it what it is, this barbarism against all various walks of life in Lebanon, as you mentioned. And I think it's really important for people to understand what they are. You know, it's really astonishing for me that someone like Zsa Zsa is a free man. It's really unconscionable, isn't it?
Yes, he was given amnesty back in 2005, and then you know how events escalated back in 2005 with the assassination of the slain Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri, and then how Lebanon went into this kind of, you know, those events, that the aim and target of which was to target the resistance in Lebanon. Then you had 2006, the Israeli aggression against Lebanon. But, you know, whoever stood in the face of the resistance has always been defeated. And Hezbollah in Lebanon is part and parcel of the fabric. It is a community. It has a large swathe of constituency. And we have to understand something, speaking of constituency, is that we are very soon approaching the elections in Lebanon, the parliamentary elections. And whatever we see, any kind of instability, any kind of events, is going to be in order to try and tip the balance of elections. Because the Lebanese forces, they know for sure that, you know, former member of parliament Walid Jumblat is no longer allying with them in Baabda and Ashouf, and he said so clearly. And also Al-Hariri, which is the future bloc, is not aligned with them in the Akkar region, in the Hermel, and somewhere else. So they are, according to this new electoral law, they will be losing a lot of seats in the forthcoming elections. And whatever they have done, Richard, they opened their own fire at themselves. This is not something that is going to pass easily. The blood of the martyrs is not going to stay on the streets. There's going to be a kind of accountability, a solid accountability, a vendetta also, not only from those particular people, the way, you know, those people who were also responsible for the events that took place in Khaldi and the killing, the cold blood killing of the people in Khaldi, and those who were also the next day in the funeral procession. Their masters, who are the servants of another master, which is a master that was and is always defeated today, defeated in Afghanistan, defeated in Iraq, defeated in Syria, defeated elsewhere, is also going to be defeated in Lebanon, Richard, sooner rather than later.
Zainab, when you speak of their masters, this is a very important point. What role do the United States, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Israel, what role do they play in this attack and in Lebanese politics in general? Is it true, for example, that the Lebanese forces militia was training in Saudi Arabia? You know, what else is the American embassy, what role does the American ambassador play in all this? And what goal are they trying to achieve here? You mentioned destabilizing the elections as one example. Is this also part of a plan to weaken the axis of resistance, to disarm Hezbollah? What about Lebanon's gas and natural resources?
Of course, everything that the Americans have been doing in the region and also in Lebanon in particular, the sanctions against Lebanon, the sanctions against lots of personalities who are allied with the resistance in Lebanon, it's a mode of trying to weaken the resistance in Lebanon and trying to turn the people of Lebanon, the people of the resistance, against their own resistance. And, you know, the American ambassador has been doing all this witchcraft, if I might say, all these kind of suspicious and all these kind of, you know, the imperial moves trying to control Lebanon and the Lebanese institutions, but she's failing. And, you know, the moment Hezbollah tried to get the ship of fuel from Iran, the next day she said that, well, we're going to get gas from Egypt through Syria. Syria that was sanctioned by the very Americans through the Caesar law. They broke the Caesar law and, you know, and she was reprimanded by her administration, saying that, well, you don't need this, Sayyid Nasrallah to do something, and then you have to retaliate the next day to show that you are strong and flexing your muscles. But anyways, she is doing her best. She is on the line of the Pompeo recommendation, still trying to, in her dreams, she dreams a lot that she dreams of disbanding and disarming Hezbollah and, you know, dismantling this kind of party and the people of it, and turning the people of the resistance and the quote-unquote Shia against Hezbollah. Well, this is just in your dreams. These are chimeras, and this is something that can never be true. Regarding the fact that we heard yesterday a very important statement by the mother of the martyr, Maryam Farhat, in yesterday events, in the massacre that took place yesterday. She said, well, they are not going to move us one iota against the resistance. We know those scenarios. We know the play, this theatrical thing that is taking place against us. We know the ultimate aims of, and we're not going to move. That's why the people of Lebanon yesterday, and I say the people of Lebanon, the true, honest people of Lebanon, they were not being dragged to a kind of civil war, to a kind of sedition, to a kind of discord, because whatever took place, it's not so much strange to us. We know these scenarios, and nobody can drag us again to a civil war.
Zainab El-Safar, thank you so much for your time. It's really a pleasure having your insightful knowledge and graceful presentation on the program. Really great speaking with you.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Richard. Thank you very much.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
to understand the Tayyuni massacre that just took place in Beirut, we have to understand the general context of Lebanon's political situation. As we've covered before on the program, Lebanon is under a de facto U.S. siege, its economy in turmoil, and as such, Lebanon remains a very fragile nation in need of political reform. As of recently, Hezbollah has been importing shipments of fuel from Iran to Lebanon, defying not only U.S. sanctions, but also its political rivals inside the country, making them look weak and incompetent, as Hezbollah bolsters its image and popularity with the Lebanese people. There are elections coming up soon in Lebanon, and political parties like Jaja's Lebanese forces want to manipulate public opinion against Hezbollah because of their weak standing and the recent political humiliations that they suffer. External actors like the United States, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates have been trying to dismantle Hezbollah for a long time, especially after Hezbollah successfully liberated South Lebanon from Israeli occupation and drove the Israeli invaders back in 2006. The aim of the Tayyuni massacre was twofold. One, murdering its supporters to try and provoke Hezbollah into retaliation. The United States, Israel, and Hezbollah's rivals in Lebanon want to paint Hezbollah not as a resistance group, but as some violent armed gang. They want to paint it as an organization that uses violence against its own people so they can try and disarm the group. That way, Hezbollah's political rivals can ascend to power inside Lebanon. The Israelis would no longer face any resistance if they attack or invade Lebanon and Syria. And the United States can go on funding Takfiri terrorists in the region and invading the Middle East with less opposition. So the first aim was to vilify Hezbollah, try and disarm them. The second aim of this massacre was to create sectarian tensions and plunge Lebanon into civil war. Hezbollah and Amal decided not to do either of those things, hence preventing the country from descending into chaos. Let us be clear, everyone has weapons in Lebanon. The difference, however, between the fascist Lebanese forces militia and Hezbollah is that Hezbollah never turns its guns on its own people. It uses them to defend Lebanon from foreign invaders and colonizers. Hezbollah is an integral part of the axis of resistance and is allied with Syria, Iran, and the popular mobilization forces in Iraq. So let's examine the events of the past week, because in Syria was bombed twice by Israel and the United States, who struck locations in Homs, south of the ancient, the beautiful city of Palmyra, killing one Syrian soldier and wounding three others. In Afghanistan, two suicide bombers struck mosques in Kunduz and Kandahar during Friday prayers, leaving over 100 people wounded or killed, most of the victims Shia Muslims of the Hazara ethnic minority. And then finally in Lebanon, this tragic massacre with snipers firing at peaceful protesters, again, most of them Shia Muslims and supporters of the resistance. All these things point to a concerted effort by the West and its regional allies to destabilize Lebanon, to provoke sectarian violence and start a civil war. They want to pit Muslims against Christians, Shia against Sunni, and destroy the multi-ethnic, multi-religious fabric of Lebanon. Amal and Hezbollah supporters were specifically targeted by fascists who have a long history of murder, and the mainstream media are trying to downplay this and hide it from them. But this plan of theirs to turn people against one another, to weaken Lebanon's security and weaken the axis of resistance, is not going to work. Their intent was clear from the beginning, and this is precisely why Hezbollah and Amal told people not to retaliate. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kHz, and in southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
There have been approximately 780 men and boys imprisoned at Guantanamo since it opened in 2002. 39 detainees remain at Gitmo following the transfer last month of Abdul Latif Nasser, a 56-year-old Moroccan held there for 19 years without charge or trial. Of those 39 prisoners, 28 have never been charged with any crime. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Judge Rules Guantanamo Detainees Imprisonment Illegal. Stay tuned for more. Weeks after a review board cleared Guantanamo Bay prisoner Asadullah Harun Gul for release, a federal judge ruled this week that the Afghan's imprisonment by the U.S. military in Cuba for over 14 years without charge or trial is illegal. In a ruling still undergoing classification review, Judge Amit P. Mehta of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia recently granted Gul's petition for a writ of habeas corpus, making him the first Guantanamo detainee in over a decade to win such a case against the government. Mehta ruled that the United States had no legal basis for imprisoning Gul, a 40-year-old militant captured in Afghanistan in 2007 because he was not a member of Al-Qaeda. This is a historic victory for the rule of law and a much-needed reminder to the U.S. government that there are limits on what it may do in the name of national security, Tara Palachi, an attorney for Gul, said in a statement, adding, "I'm hopeful that Asadullah will soon be reunited with his family." While a prisoner at Guantanamo, Gul has been subjected to physical and psychological torture, including being beaten, hung by his wrists, deprived of food and water, and prevented from praying, as well as sleep deprivation, extreme cold temperatures, and solitary confinement, according to the human rights group Reprieve. Mark Maher, a lawyer at Reprieve US, who also represents Gold, said, "We are thrilled for Assad. The federal court has finally affirmed what Assad has known for so long. He should be home with his family, and his detention is unlawful." This is a landmark ruling, added Maher. For 20 years, successive U.S. administrations have asserted the right to imprison people indefinitely, without charge or trial. Guantanamo was built on the shakiest of legal foundations, and that has never been more clear than it's today. The ruling does not mean that Gold's release is imminent. The Biden administration can appeal the decision and, as the New York Times noted, the U.S. government has argued it has the authority to indefinitely imprison Gold, citing his alleged connections to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and noting the continuation of the 20-year so-called war on terror. However, on October 7th, the Interagency Periodic Review Board, which is tasked with determining whether Guantanamo prisoners pose a security threat to the United States, approved the transfer of Gold. And Sanad Yislam al-Kazimi, a Yemeni captured in Dubai in 2003 and accused of being one of the slain Al-Qaeda chief Osama bin Laden's bodyguards. There have been approximately 780 men and boys imprisoned at Guantanamo since it opened in 2002. 39 detainees remain at Gitmo following the transfer last month of Abdelatif Nasser, a 56-year-old Moroccan held there for 19 years without charge or trial. Of those 39 prisoners, 28 have never been charged with any crime. Back in Afghanistan, Gold's family cheered news of Mehta ruling. "This is such happy, sweet news for our family. We now pray that Asadullah is sent back home quickly, where he belongs," Roman Khan, Gold's brother, said in a statement, adding, "The family has eyes only to see him again. We are all waiting for him. His wife, his young daughter Maryam, his parents, me, his nieces and nephews. He has spent more than 14 years of his life in this dangerous and terrible prison without charge," added Khan. "We are thankful to the judges and to everyone who continue to press for his freedom."
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. We witnessed the spectacular and awe-inspiring natural beauty of the Kaluts, or Yardangs, in the western part of Dasht-e-Lut in Iran. Rising up to 80 meters, these streamlined ridges have been carved by the wind out of the clay and sand lining the desert floor, creating a magnificent array of high-rising sculptures and lying parallel to the prevailing winds. The Yardangs are some of the world's most prominent. Stay with us as we follow Javad Gharoyi, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, as he introduces more of Iran's desert wonders to us.
Early the next morning, I was still sleepy and tired, but some of the most beautiful natural views revealed themselves in the moments before sunrise. The cold and the dark couldn't stop me from exploring the natural beauties near my camp. The early hours of morning in the natural world fills you with energy. Filled to the brim with that energy that emanates from the peace and tranquility bestowed upon this land by God Almighty. I started my day that promised to be a good one. I spent 3 hours exploring the areas around my tent, taking beautiful photos of the unmatched scenery of the Kaluts, a precious gift by Mother Nature to those who appreciate her. It was time for me to leave the imaginary city of Kaluts, a city with great potential for becoming a destination for responsible tourists and nature travelers. The most beautiful natural scenes should either be visited in the early hours of morning or sometime around sundown. I got up at 6 o'clock this morning and was able to take spectacular snaps of the natural beauties around here with this very camera. I have to say, I love Iran with all my being because of its very rich culture and its remarkably diverse natural beauties. It's time to go now. I have to pack up. I gotta put my tent back into my backpack and head out for the Kaluts again. This is my last day here. I can't stay here much longer because I'm running out of food and water. Not only the Kaluts, but the entire vast Lut region are considered as an invaluable natural museum in the world. All by itself, the Lut Desert is home to a world of numerous beauties, the like of which are scattered in different places across our planet. Without a doubt, it's among the most beautiful deserts on Earth. The Yalon mega dunes with their rare views, the Kaluts, the star-shaped dunes, the beautiful valleys in the heart of Lut, the hottest part of Dashtulut, which is Gandum Berian, a large plateau covered in dark lava, the unique vegetation, including small trees named Saxols, the Martian or miniature mountains on the fringes of Lut, the central hole, the Dolphin Valley comprised of rock formations eroded by wind, Dashtakashk, and the plant and animal species endemic to Lut. Add to all that the villages with their unique desert architecture, people whose cultures go back 6,000 years. Thank you. was a long walk. My GPS is telling me I've walked around 36 kilometers through the Kalutz. This is nearly the end of my trek into the Kalutz. Another very beautiful feature of the Kalutz of Kerman, in other words, the Kalutz of Shahdad, is the Nepka Forest Park. These very beautiful plants you see behind me here are in fact the trees that have formed this Nepka Forest Park. Only two species, salt cedars and saxels, which have grown here and created this beautiful and unique landscape. This area obviously looks different from others. The Nepka's Forest Park forms the vegetation on the fringe of the Kalut area. But this green patch fades away as you move from the cold mountains of Sirj to the hot, dry Kalutz. And in the heart of the Kalutz, there is hardly any vegetation at all. But Mother Nature has created a matchless forest in the area between the Sirj mountains and the Kalutz. This strange land formation I'm standing next to is not your simple hill. It is the world's biggest natural vase known as the Nepka. This phenomenon is called Nepka in the African Sahara, Shur Moro in the central areas of Iran, and Talagaz by those living on the eastern and southeastern plains of Iran. When sandstorms blow past the vegetation in this area, they leave behind some of the dirt and sand at the foot of these plants. When the wind blows, some of the sand and dirt is trapped in the trees and crashes to the ground, creating a mound over time. In order to survive, the trees use their long roots to absorb water and other nutrients buried underground. The dirt around the shrubs and trees contain more moisture. This relative moisture keeps the sand and earth in place around the plant. Of course, that leads to a portion of the trunk, branches, and leaves being buried, which in turn contributes to the solidification of the sand near the plant. Every natural Nepka vase is named according to the species it hosts. The Nepkas are called Talagaz or Talatal by the locals in this region. Another unique feature of Lut are these same Nepkas. They are the tallest natural vases in the world. The Nepkas of this kind have been seen in Africa too, but the ones in Africa are barely 3 meters tall. At their tallest, the Nepkas in Iran are 10 meters tall. Normally, Nepkas grow on flat surfaces. They best grow on moist land. The shape of the Nepka depends on the size, density, and growth rate of the host plant. In this Nepka forest, the dominant species is the salt cedar. My goodness, it looks more like a miracle. Just look how God instilled the hope for life in these salt cedars and saxels. When they're just small seedlings, winds dump massive amounts of sand onto them. But driven by their strong will to live, they continue to grow in order to survive. The battle between the wind and sand on one hand and these trees on the other has been going on forever. It's been around for millions of years. But what is really very important is that hope keeps everything and everyone alive. And these trees, because of their intrinsic sense of hope, the will for life, put their roots down and stand tall. They continue to grow as a means of survival. It's going to become stormy very soon. Desert storms are very dangerous. So what you need to do is find shelter somewhere or leave that area immediately. Fortunately, I'm very close to my next destination, and I think I'm not going to run into any trouble. But I have to get going immediately, or I'm going to get sand and dirt all over my body and stuff. My camera crew and I were taken off guard by the sudden change of weather and the subsequent sandstorm. One of the biggest powers of nature in a desert is the ability of sand and dust to penetrate each and every orifice during a storm, and our equipment was no exception. Sandstorms are among the biggest dangers of a desert. In some cases, such storms continue to blow for days and can cost nature travelers their lives. But there are other dangers lurking in other parts of this vast plain. Therefore, the best way to ensure a safe trip to Lut is to make the necessary arrangements with the relevant authorities in Kerman province and the city of Shahdad. From Shahdad, I had to walk around 250 kilometers to the west of the province, to a place only 15 kilometers away from Rafsanjan. Kerman is a province with limited water resources. Many of the deep wells in the province have dried up. But deep in the heart of Rafsanjan's crisis-hit nature, there is a canyon that sparkles like a diamond. You might be thinking this isn't Iran, that I'm speaking to you from another country. But you're wrong. This is our beloved Iran, and I'm now standing atop a scary deep canyon, the Raga Grand Canyon of Rafsanjan. Valleys and canyons are strange yet beautiful natural phenomena, and they become even more beautiful if their emergence is not the result of orogeny, rather if it's the result of thousands or millions of years of erosion by wind, sand, and water of flat plains. Raga Grand Canyon is one such ravine, a peerless, pristine valley in Kerman province. I was amazed at the view of the canyon from above. The pointed cones, the big and small columns carved out by erosion, the arcs, the partitions and wall-like strips were only a few of all the beautiful features of this canyon. Raga is around 20 kilometers long. Its width varies between 3 and 100 kilometers, and in some places it is around 80 meters deep. Walking on top of it could have been very dangerous. My goodness, it's really scary, but it's magnificent at the same time. At this point, I think it's around 70 meters deep from where I'm standing. If I fall into it, there will be nothing left of me. It's dangerous to be here because the earth here is very soft and can slide at any moment. So you'll have to keep a safe distance while walking along these beautiful walls. It's ruggedly beautiful indeed. You can get the most beautiful view of the canyon from up here, but every side of it offers its own unique beauty. What I'm really happy about is the fact that there is no construction work happening anywhere in a 20-kilometer radius. There are no roads. That's why this ravine has maintained its pristine status, and of course, the area around it too. My hope is that we can preserve this untouched ravine and its surroundings the way they are and leave them to the next generation, and they to the generation that comes after them, just like the way it looks now. I hope so. The canyon's geomorphology and its pristine environs made for beautiful scenery, and that had provided a good habitat for certain species of animals in and around it. This region and this gorge are so intact, they've become home to various species of birds, such as eagles that have built their nests in recesses high on the walls where they feel safe. I'm very excited and counting every minute for the walk on the bed of the canyon, but the best time to do it will be tomorrow because I don't have enough time for it today.